Aloha, this is Catherine Cruz. Mahalo for joining us here on The Conversation, Hawaii Talks. It's December 16th. Organizers of the Honolulu Marathon are still on a runner's high after this weekend's races, humbled by their records broken for this premier event. We began the week with a look at the Bill of Rights in this country's constitution. Today, we look at the state constitution. And we get the latest on efforts to expand commercial fishing access in Papahanaumokuakea. A new proposal is eyeing nearshore lobsters and corals. Plus, we take a trip underneath the waves and explore the shipwrecks of centuries-old whaling vessels. And we meet two students from Waipahu High School who took home a top prize from the Future Farmers of America Convention. You're tuned to The Conversation here on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. The challenge of this weekend's stormy weather may have been more stressful for the organizers of the 53rd Honolulu Marathon than the runners. We caught up with Marathon Association President Jim Barahal this morning. He was able to exhale after Sunday's event, which broke attendance records and attracted elite runners from across the globe in cementing the race's standings in the sports world.
There was a deluge at the start. I mean, the start was at about 4 o'clock, the skies just opened. It was unbelievable, and it stopped at about 4:45. The runners seemed to embrace it, and that didn't seem to cause any problems for them. What we were concerned about as organizers was if there was anything like lightning in the area, things like that, that it potentially forced us to, if not cancel the race, you know, stop it in place. So that was a big concern for a couple of days that we were looking at, and that creates a lot of planning. We were also very concerned, due to our no time limit, about some of the people that would take a very long time to finish. And these are people that are often overcoming severe challenges, and we want to be able to have them finish the race. But we were concerned with this rain as it got dark and as the visibility out there could get poor, and they would be out there so long that the possibility of something like hypothermia could come into play. So it was a lot of planning about what might happen if the storm was even worse than we thought. And fortunately, none of that happened.
I worried for those runners when the skies let loose early in the morning, and I thought, oh, I hope they have an extra pair of dry socks, because you don't want blisters.
It was really something. I want to give a shout out to our race director, J.J. Johnson, who really is the unsung hero. He's the man behind the scenes that really is in charge of all the operations of the race, and to our whole team, all our coordinators, start line, finish line, Kapi'olani Park, medical, so much going on out there. So they're really the people that make this race go. And the amazing thing, talking about the rain and what happened there at the start, it's also kind of unspoken that this thing is going rain or shine. It's the nature of the beast, and the runners know that, and we know that. It's going off at 5 o'clock. That's one of the beauties of it. There's very few things in life that you can say, I know exactly at this time and place this is what's going to happen. But we know that going into race week, you know, if it's raining, pouring, whatever, here we go at 5 a.m. But there's definitely an overhang from worrying about what might happen. And we were planned for that. I mean, for example, J.J., you know, he's arranging buses that if for some reason we have to call a halt to this thing. And it really opened up again a couple times into the race, like 1 o'clock again, and then 3 o'clock. But fortunately, it kind of let up a little for a while, and we were able to get everybody home safely. So that's incredible.
And talk about the first, you know, the record set.
Well, we did the Mary Mile, which has become a really popular event. I think this is the eighth time that we've done it. The mile was designed for people who were coming here to run the marathon to have their friends and family, instead of just cheering for them, could actually get out on the road the day before. It's fun to be able to go up and down Kalakaua Avenue and to have an active experience and to, you know, to begin that first step and feel what it's like to get out on the road and do a mile. But we realized pretty quickly that it was much more than that. And so many people from Hawaii, so many local people do this, and little kids and grandparents, and it's an exhilarating kind of experience, people in costumes. So it's become a really, really fun event. And we also wanted to have the fastest running possible out there, because all the over 3,000 finishers in the mile are there at the finish line down there at the beach, and they know that the professionals are going to run right after them. And we clear that road, and then we have 16 of the top men and women in the world. We do it as a chase format, where the women this year got a 31-second head start. First across the finish line wins $10,000. And we found that all the thousands of people that run the mile and people in Waikiki line that road. It's so exciting. And this year was kind of the culmination of several years of this event, in which Sinclair Johnson set an American record for women in the road mile. So she now holds the American record set on Kalakaua Avenue. And that's very exciting for all of us. So that event is growing, as are all the events. They're growing astronomically, actually.
It is really impressive. I mean, when I ran that mile, I think that year it was the first year that the winner took part in a road race. And so it was so exciting to see those elite runners come across. I mean, lightning fast.
Yeah, I mean, we had 12 Olympians in that race and 4 world champions. And many of them don't run road races. These are track athletes who run in the Olympics and world championships. And Jared Neguse, 2 years ago, who you're referring to, his first road race ever, is the current American record holder in the mile. He's run a 3:43 mile, which is the third fastest in history. And he was a bronze medalist in the Paris Olympics at 1,500 meters. So, and he was here this year. He didn't win this year, but he was here. And so the caliber of athletes that are out there is really astonishing. And, you know, it's arguably the preeminent road mile in the world now. I think the only one that you could even put in the same sentence would be the Fifth Avenue mile. And they may argue that they're number one, and we could argue we're number one. But I don't think there's any question that the two top road miles in the world now are the Fifth Avenue mile in New York and the Kalakaua Mary mile. They stand alone right now at the top.
And talk about the numbers that you attracted this year, because you had gotten some funding from Hawaii Tourism Authority, and so you were able to promote the race, and it paid off in those numbers.
Yeah, we're appreciative of the relationship and the support, Chairman Tokioka and all the people at the HTA that have gotten behind this event. With that support and our sponsors, Japan Airlines, SGC, NTT Docomo, and our support from the Outrigger Hotel, it takes a lot of money to put on an event of this nature. You know, we're growing dramatically. We're up 27% across all markets from last year. We're up 60% in a 2-year period. We had over 43,000 entrants this year. We had over 33,000 finishers between the start to part 10K and the mile. And so this thing is moving up to the top of the list in the world, but it does take a lot of money to put this event on. And, you know, there's been a lot of talk about sports tourism here recently. Hawaii has lost some events. The Century Golf Tournament on Maui, at least for this year, the Great Aloha Run, is no longer happening. We lost the Pro Bowl years ago. And so there's a real interest now in sports tourism, what that is, what that means, and how it can be a positive force. I think the Honolulu Marathon, quite frankly, stands alone right now in terms of the size and scope of it and how many people come here. Over 30,000 participants came from outside of Hawaii, which means about 60,000 people, because they don't come alone. And so the scope of it is pretty staggering. And I'm not saying that like to brag or anything. I'm just saying even we are stunned as the organizers by the unbelievable growth of this event. And it looks like it's going to continue.
That was Jim Barrow talking about the success of the Honolulu Marathon, the Mary Mile, and the Start to Park races that took place this weekend. The competitions broke participation records, and congrats to marathon winners Sige Wildebanos from Eritrea, who ran the men's race in 2 hours and 13 minutes, and Kali Hauger-Thackeray from England, who ran the women's race in 2 hours and 30 minutes. Their high-altitude training in Arizona paid off in their winning times.
HPR is celebrating the season with special programming on HPR 1 and HPR 2. See the full lineup at hawaiipublicradio.org/holiday. Sponsored by Maui Fruit Jewels as a gift to the community.
Support for HPR comes from Treehouse, specializing in traditional film photography, serving local photographers since 2012, located at Salt Kakaako and at treehouse-shop.com.
The Hawaii Institute for Public Affairs marks its 25th year with a recent report about the decline in local news coverage in Hawaii. It sees this trend as a threat to democracy and civil engagement. To encourage more civil discourse across the state, HIPAA is focused now on the state constitution and a question that will come up before voters about the possibility of making amendments through a constitutional convention. We talked to the organization's incoming president, Perry Arrowsmith, and Vice President Cameron Deptula. Arrowsmith, start us off.
So HIPAA is back. That's the big story that we want to share. And we are looking at promoting the future of civic discourse here in the state of Hawaii by taking on a couple different initiatives. So the first initiative is our News Desert Project. We're looking at the future of news media here in the state of Hawaii, what that looks like. And we're also starting up what we're calling the Center for Hawaii's Constitution. And what we're doing there is we're promoting civic discourse about what's in our state constitution. We think our state constitution is an incredibly unique document. It's a very special document, but not enough people know what's in there. And with the next constitutionally mandated election coming up in 2028 to decide whether or not there should be another constitutional convention, we want folks to have the facts about what's in our Constitution and what makes it so unique. So presently, we're looking at ways to encourage and foster civic discourse about what's in our Constitution.
I had the opportunity to listen to you folks talk, and Cameron, you were very passionate about this. Why is it so important to you?
Yeah. So if you look at our Constitution, we have a great state Constitution. It is the fundamental civic document that really underscores all of government functions and also as a representation of state values as well. In terms of civic documents, the Constitution stands at the top. However, a lot of people don't know we have a state constitution. It is a document that is probably under-leveraged and it's neglected in terms of education with folks. As Perry mentioned, we do have this important vote and this important choice that is coming up in 2028. So November 7th, 2028, the general election, all of Hawaii voters will have the choice on their general election ballot of whether to support or oppose a constitutional convention, which is an opportunity for local people to elect delegates, and those delegates will then deliberate on changes and amendments to the Constitution. And then those changes and amendments would then go back to the people for ultimate ratification. So this is an important issue that is coming up, and it's our belief that folks really need to have the opportunity to be educated and have resources about our state constitution. If you go online, it's actually kind of hard to find out and find resources about the state constitution. At HIPAA, we're trying to fill that void, and we're trying to bring actual resources that are easily accessible, easily digestible for regular people, educators, students, to be able to dive into this very important issue.
Yes, and during the last CONCON, I mean, I know just over the many decades, talking to people who were part of that, Governor John Wahee, the list goes on. But to hear that passion about why it's so important, and then the current times that we're living in, where we have seen so many challenges, do you think maybe the times that we live in will get people engaged?
I think in many respects, second part of your question is an answer in itself. Folks crave discourse about what the future of Hawaii looks like. And we've talked about the news desert. I also think there's a civic desert here in the state of Hawaii. People want to learn more about what's in their constitution. You mentioned John Wahee and other delegates at the 1978 CON who are still around. I think they also want to be a part of that conversation. The median age of a person here in Hawaii today is around 40 years old. And our last constitutional convention, it occurred in 1978, which means that a majority of Hawaii's residents weren't even alive when the last CON was held. But folks here in Hawaii, they're very proud of Hawaii's unique identity. They're very proud of our unique political culture, and our constitution is an expression of that political culture. And there's a lot of really big debates going on here in Hawaii about our future. So we think that the conversation about what the next con could look like, if we choose to have one, it could serve as a great vehicle for discussions about a lot of the big issues we're taking on today.
Yeah, it almost seems people are being asked almost on a daily basis, what do you stand for? Because we see our institutions just being undermined. And you're saying, what's important here? What's of value?
Yeah, I think that there is, you know, despite the, I think the Constitution being something that isn't so well known in the public, there is a lot of attention around it, and there are a lot of attempts to actually reform it. So if you look legislatively, since like just 2013, there have been 432 proposed amendments. So it's not like there's a lack of ideas or a lack of interest in the Constitution as a vehicle for change or an incredibly important platform that can be improved on, but only a very slim number of those actually get through and actually get to voters. So only about six of those 432 amendments have actually been put to voters, and voters voted on it and approved those changes. That just underscores that there is some interest in this. There are ideas, right? Many of them don't have the chance to get to regular voters. I think just for us, being able to give folks the opportunity to have this conversation and to have a discussion like the one that we're having about the Constitution, that in and of itself is a fundamentally important step that we can take as a community, right, to reaffirm our values, right, to talk about what kind of policy changes we might be looking for. And whether that manifests in a convention, whether it manifests in good policymaking at the legislature, we think just having that conversation to begin with is going to be the important thread as a bare minimum as a community.
And, you know, we see so many challenges, like for reproductive rights, the issues around Roe versus Wade, and then it forces the states to figure out, all right, is there some way that we can codify some of these principles just in case something gets undone on the Supreme Court level? Is there something we can do for our laws locally? Do you see more emphasis on things like that?
It's up to the people of Hawaii. I mean, we at HIPA, we don't explicitly support having another constitutional convention. I just want to be clear about that. What we support is the conversation and the debate over whether there should be another con. And that starts with people becoming aware of the fact that Hawaii, for instance, has a right to privacy that some folks would contend is actually much stronger than those rights guaranteed under the Federal Bill of Rights. What would it look like for Hawaii, hypothetically, what would it look like for Hawaii to perhaps guarantee certain rights that are presently not guaranteed under the U.S. Constitution? I think that's a real conversation that the residents of Hawaii need to have, especially those residents who are presently concerned about what's happening at the national level.
And then what's the plan going forward then to put this to the voters and educate them about the pros and cons?
Yeah, so I mean, we're working on actual research related to the Constitution to make it easier for folks to actually access. So one great example of that is we've been working to compile all of the amendments that have happened to the state constitution since its first form that came out in 1950 as a result of a constitutional convention in territorial Hawaii days, so way long ago. And that document has gone under some very significant changes over time. What we've done is we've actually created this series. It's called the Evolving Constitution Series, and it shows each change that has happened from this initial document over time, when those changes were made, how they were made. So you can actually show what has been omitted, what has been added, what has been moved around in the Constitution. And those are all very relevant kind of pieces, right, to this document. So it's a very fascinating look at just the history of this document. But as an early example of some of the work that we've been doing, that's just one example. So for the first time, you can look at this document and see, wow, what has changed? What rights have we gained? What have we lost, right, as a community? And by what mechanism have those happened through? So that's just one example. We'll be doing other research. And most importantly, I think, is where we'll be trying to work with communities to have this discussion, to talk about the Constitution so that there is a familiarity, right? And folks have the chance to engage with this document before that very important vote that'll come up in 2028.
And then I know you're talking about engaging a whole new younger generation, and you've got to reach them where they're at. So it's through social media or TikTok or whatever. But then, yeah, how do you get them engaged in this process, to make them care.
So we're looking at ways to engage with schools. Young people still like to talk story face-to-face too, but that's presently something that we're doing. We're doing outreach to public schools and also to private schools to look for ways where we can engage with schools. And then also, there's existing institutions like the State Youth Commission, the City and County of Honolulu's Youth Commission. There's existing bodies that already function to mobilize youth. So a big question we're currently asking at HEPA is, what can we do to also engage those organizations? There's lots of youth who want to get involved. They're already involved. It's just a matter of us connecting with one another face-to-face.
Okay. And then, I don't know, any other final thoughts about what you want to leave our listeners with?
I guess with this discussion, it always comes down to democracy. Democracy is really scary because it requires individuals to exert some degree of responsibility over their destiny. And in Hawaii's preamble, the preamble to our state constitution, we talk about how the people of the state of Hawaii, they reserve the right to control their own destiny. So HEPA, we see ourselves as playing a small part in that process. We want to give people the tools that they need to exercise some degree of control over their destinies here in Hawaii. And we're really excited about what the next few years hold. We're hopeful that this conversation generates future conversations. We're going to keep engaging with communities across the state, and we're excited for what comes next.
Okay, so self-determination. Imua.
Imua.
That's right.
Yep. All right, thank you, gentlemen, for coming down here this morning.
Aloha.
Aloha.
That was Perry Arrowsmith and Cameron Deptula, who are with the Hawaii Institute for Public Affairs. It marks its 25th year creating an initiative to begin a conversation as we consider whether to hold a constitutional convention to review and amend our state constitution. At this hour, a meeting of the Western Pacific Regional Fisheries Management Council is getting underway. It's considering new proposals to lift commercial fishing bans in Hawaii's Papahanaumokuakea Marine Conservation Area. Joining us with the story is Honolulu Civil Beat's Marcel Honore. Good morning.
Morning, Catherine. Thanks for having me.
Yes. Tell us about this. I mean, this meeting, you know, is underway now.
Yeah. So, this is Westpac, and again, for people who might not be familiar, this is one of the regional fishery councils that advises on fishery management and policy, how much fish, you know, can be taken from these distant part of the oceans at any given time. So it's pretty significant. And what they've been acting on really in the last few months is in response to an order that President Trump made earlier in the year. It said, look into opening up the protected marine national monument areas to commercial fishing, you know, reopen those areas, essentially. And so Westpac, really, it's you know, the leadership there has always really opposed bans of commercial fishing in these areas. When these have been, you know, brought forward, their leaders have always kind of come out testifying in opposition to any of those. So they are moving forward with that order from Trump and looking into ways to open up these marine national monuments. That is something that they're taking back up again today, pretty much as we speak. And what's interesting is that they're not just looking at, you know, the longline vessels and some of these deep sea vessels and fleets, right? That fish the ahi and the pelagic species. But some of the proposals that and the options that they're looking at today talk about fisheries that are much closer to shore, you know, as close as in Papahanaumokuakea, it would be up to the 3 mile marker, you know, 3 miles offshore, which is where the federal jurisdiction starts. So you could potentially be talking about reopening bottom fishing in those waters, even lobster fishing, which, you know, decades ago, that fishery was really, it crashed due to overfishing. So that could be, you know, something down the line, but what Westpac has been telling me so far is that they really are interested in getting bottom fishing specifically in Papahanaumokuakea.
And then explain something to me. So I know that there's the monument protections, but then there's also additional like sanctuary protections for these waters?
Yeah. So one of the things that's you know, in this discussion, there's been, you know, a lot of debate over lifting the commercial fishing bans in the monuments, but one of the wrinkles that hasn't gotten a lot of attention so far is that in Papanaumokuakea and also in a spot called the Rose Atoll down in American Samoa, those areas are also now marine national sanctuaries. So it's like an added layer of protection. The boundaries of those sanctuaries overlay the same waters as the monument. And for Papanaumokuakea, this was actually very deliberate. You know, we started hearing from conservation groups late in the Biden administration's tenure, saying that they were moving forward to try and create not just a monument at Papanaumokuakea, but also a sanctuary to give added protection should, say, Trump come back into office, because, you know, Trump was trying to roll back some of the monuments during his first term. And that's exactly what happened. They got it in at the kind of at the tail end and the beginning of the Trump administration. So even as Westpac moves forward and you know, is advising on how to reimplement commercial fishing in these protected monuments, what everybody seems to agree on is they're also going to have to now deal with the sanctuary and kind of the difference between the monuments and the sanctuaries. The monuments are created by U.S. presidents under what's called the Antiquities Act. Sanctuaries are created by Congress. So that's essentially kind of the difference in what's happening there.
Okay, well, we'll see if all those predictions get undone. But thanks so much, Marcel.
Thanks, Catherine.
That was Honolulu Civil Beat reporter Marcel Henri talking about his story on the Westpac Fisheries Council. It's meeting at this hour to consider lifting bans on fishing throughout Papanaumokuakea. Find his story at civilbeat.org. Stories that shipwrecks can tell. There are at least 10 whaling ships that sank hundreds of years ago within the boundary of Papanaumokuakea Marine National Monument. For maritime archaeologist Jason Raup, the area is like an undersea laboratory for learning about the history of whaling. Raup is an assistant professor at East Carolina University and the author of a new book, Wrecked on a Reef. The book traces the rise of American whaling in the Pacific Ocean. Raup spoke with The Conversation's Maddie Bender about the rise of American whaling in 1750.
There's a moment where the technology needed to boil the blubber of whales into the oil was installed on board ships. And so from that point, Americans then no longer needed to be close to land because of worried about spoilage of the blubber or, you know, to boil out to have those fires. The point is they started to explore and just soon were all over the Atlantic. And by the late 18th century, they rounded Cape Horn, which was a pretty treacherous journey on board a relatively small ship. And when they entered the Pacific, it was an unprecedented occurrence, the number of sperm whales that they found there. And of course, the important thing to understand is that there are multiple species of whales that were hunted. And sperm whales were considered to be the absolute best. The oil that was produced from their blubber burned brighter than anything else. So once you passed around Cape Horn and entered the Pacific, it was like a veritable gold rush for ships. And soon the entire American whale fishery and British whale fishery sort of followed around Cape Horn. Voyages got longer. They spent more and more time out at sea. And clearly, they started to better understand the geography of the Pacific Ocean. So the further they explored, the more they found suitable harbors. And one of the most important places that they found was the Hawaiian Islands. So in so many of the islands, there were safe ports. There were great opportunities to reprovision with fresh food and water. And so slowly, the whale fisheries, both American and British, really other countries as well, but the American and British play the biggest part in the history of the whale fishery in the Pacific. They establish these ports at Honolulu and at Lahaina and Hilo. And ultimately, through various political, you know, maneuvering, the American whale fishery kind of became the more dominant in the Hawaiian Islands. And then, you know, of course, over time, more and more, they realized what amazing fishers and sailors that Native Hawaiians were, both men and women. But over time, Hawaiian sailors were brought on board the ships and very quickly adapted and rose through the ranks of American whale ships in particular.
Not only do you study whaling, you study specifically the shipwrecks. And I think it's probably important for listeners to understand just how dangerous and treacherous these islands that they're sailing to and around could really be.
Well, it's really, you're at the control of the elements. So no matter what great sailors all of these whalers would have been, you know, at the end of the day, you're only as good as the position that you have in the ocean. And if you encounter storms, if you encounter unsavory conditions for days at a time, you lose the ability to sort of take note of your position. And so, you know, we think of these ships as being wrecked, but in a lot of cases, one could argue that it wasn't the neglect on the part of the captain or the officers that led to it, but instead it was really just being at the sort of the mercy of the open ocean.
And how many are we talking based on the research that you did reading the historical records and then also archaeology, what you can really see under the sea that still remains of these shipwrecks?
We know that in the Northwestern Hawaiian Islands, I've often joked, it's like this incredibly long, like 2,000 kilometer long laboratory for studying whale ships. Because it's so remote, we know that people wouldn't really have gone out to sort of salvage them in the same way that, you know, you might have found something that was wrecked or lost around Maui or Oahu. From what we know, 10 ships were lost, 10 whale ships were lost, and 5 of those have been identified by archaeologists with the National Marine Sanctuaries Program.
And so you had the chance to go out there and look at some of these wrecks. Do you have favorite sites that you visited or favorite wrecks?
Anybody that's been up there will tell you it's just a magical place. It's unlike most anything in the world that you can imagine, because it's just such a remote open ocean environment where you just have this, really, it's like a ship trap, right? You just have these reefs that are barely emergent that otherwise you may not have seen until you ran into them. And so, you know, in some cases you have ships that broke apart and sank in these incredible coral reef environments. And of course, because of the protections afforded to the monument for so long, the sea life in those places are just truly amazing, where you look around and there's monk seals swimming around next to you and giant alua and all these various fish. But I think of all the sites that I visited, we identified one that was, it's not the earliest wreck, but it's probably considered to be the most historically probably well-known or maybe significant, if that's the word to use. And it's the 1823 wreck of the American whale ship Two Brothers. So Two Brothers was an interesting story in and of itself. There's a story of a ship that was sunk by a whale that rammed it. And this was the whale ship Essex. So Essex was sunk in a really remote part of the ocean, and the officers and crew were able to make it onto the small boats with very little before they had to abandon the ship because it sank so quickly. And then they spent 92 days at sea in this just harrowing journey. A couple of the boats were lost. Several of the people, there was, you know, cannibalism. There was all sorts of things that occur, you know, in 92 days at sea in an open small boat. In the end, the captain of that ship was a man named George Pollard. And Pollard made his way to Peru and eventually made passage back to Nantucket on a ship called Two Brothers. And in that voyage back to Nantucket, I guess he had endeared himself to the owners of the vessel. And 6 months after he returned from this awful experience, he set out again to sort of prove that it was a fluke, it wasn't his fault, and he would go out, only to find 18 months later he's wrecked on a reef in Hawaii. The wreck itself is just, you know, I've really been fortunate in my career to work in a lot of places and look at a lot of wrecks. And man, that's one that, you know, like, it's just a textbook definition of how a shipwreck breaks apart and how you can see the story that's told through the survivors' accounts in the way that the site is now positioned around the reef. The story goes that the ship was sailing for a couple of weeks in consort with another vessel called Martha. And the two vessels had just experienced really poor weather for days and days. And so they really didn't know supposedly where they were. So remember, this is 1823. Really, the opening of the reason that ships were going through that region at that time was just the opening of a new hunting ground called the Japan Grounds. And that really only opened in 1819. So this is really, really early. People were still kind of exploratory through these areas. So the story goes that two brothers and Martha separate. And this is in February of 1823. So we all know that, you know, this is when the big swells hit the Pacific. And one of the survivors' accounts talks about how the ship grounded on a reef and they thought all was lost. And the captain, of course, George Pollard, was catatonic. He was literally frozen and just like, how could this be? You know, what's going on? And then they thought, you know, this is all where it's all lost. Let's go ahead and try and get the boats out and get out of here. Then a wave picks the ship up and refloats it. And so you think, great, this is all going to work out, only to then be smashed down back onto that reef and the stern broken up. So then you lose your rudder so you can't steer. At this point, you know, they're about to cut the masts with axes, and Pollard comes to life and says, no, if you do that, then the small boats are going to be smashed as well. So they get off of the vessel, and then it sort of drifts and founders over to a nearby reef. And it was only later, once we mapped the site, we found one section, the section over on the reef. We mapped that and noticed that there were some things that we might expect missing. The next year, Dr. Gleason went back with other friends, the diving safety officer for the Hawaii Institute of Marine Biology at the time. And they were doing another study to kind of look at the reef and the wreck and sort of compare the two, and found a whole nother section of the wreck, which later we realized coincided with the breaking up of the stern of the vessel, because so much of what we expect to find in the stern of a whale ship at that time is associated with the captain's quarters and sort of the afterguard, you'd refer to it. And that's where we found, you know, China plates and really amazing things. And so, long and short, you can really see it archaeologically. If you sort of take that 40,000 foot view, you can see that the stern is in this one area. And then across this small channel, evidence of the ship foundering onto that reef. And then all of the rigging is on the far side of the reef. So it appears that the ship sort of made its way over, laid over on one side, and then all of the rigging falls over. And of course, then, you know, it's open ocean environment. The elements take over and wood boring worms eat all the wood, and all we're left with is kind of the material culture and the artifacts. So it's great. It's a real mystery, and, you know, it's a detective story.
Is there anything else that you want to add or you want listeners to know about your work?
No. I mean, you know, I'm happy to say, like, I've been so lucky to work in Hawaii. And I was thinking just the other day about all of the great trips I've had out to the islands and to the places that I've been able to work. And then I still have just a list as long as, you know, my arm of sites that I would love to look for. There's so many amazing stories, everything from Cleopatra's barge on Kauai to other wrecks in the Northwestern Hawaiian Islands, the World War II research that we've done recently, myself and Dr. Dominic Bush and Dr. Justin Dunavant. We worked off of the Ocean Exploration Trust's vessel on a National Geographic funded project to study the remains of World War II training losses in the Ao'ao Channel, you know, around Lanai and around Maui. So, I mean, it's truly a magical place. And there's also so much more to be done. And just recently, the Polynesian Voyaging Society was out a few years back. And from what I understand, they anchored very close to the wreck of two brothers. And I think, you know, while they were kind of taking a break on Hokulea, someone was swimming around and saw something, and they were like, is this another wreck? And I was really fortunate that some of the folks at the monument reached out to Kelly, and then Kelly and I both were able to contribute. And so we're now working with the National Marine Sanctuaries program to try and tell that story. Some of my colleagues were able to get out to the site a few months ago. And so I kind of had my first virtual dives, as it were. You know, it's an exciting shipwreck, and it tells another story of those islands that I don't think people know anything about, like the seal fishery that was happening out there. And as I've looked into that story, I realized, oh my gosh, this could be another book. You know, it's just such a fascinating story. The connection to the Hawaiian Islands is truly, yeah, it's amazing.
Jason Raup, thank you so much for taking the time today.
Thank you so very much.
Yeah, that was HPR's Maddie Bender talking with maritime historian and archaeologist Jason Raup. His book, Wrecked on a Reef, is out this week.
Support for HPR comes from the Honolulu Museum of Art, featuring the films of Andrei Tarkovsky through December 27th, including Solaris and Mirror. Schedule and tickets at honolulumuseum.org.
From a European conflict zone,
driving north from Kyiv, the signs of war start to be more visible,
to hard times in Southeast Asia.
I meet a man who has been waiting in line for diesel for 6 days.
To the astonishing beauty of remote places.
My welcome to the waters off of East Greenland has come from two whales.
Let us take you there. Listen to the world.
Beginning this afternoon at 1.
Support for HPR comes from HMSA, celebrating over 87 years of dedication in supporting the health and well-being of the people of Hawaii with a commitment to caring for the community. Learn more at hmsa.com.
Two students from Waipahu High School made their mark on the 98th Annual Future Farmers of America Convention and Expo in Indianapolis. Nicholas Nishimura and Lakeisha Keetog won a social science award in the Agri-Science Fair. Their project used social media to spur action on climate change. Nishimura is the state president for Future Farmers of America, and Keetog is the state secretary. They recently talked with the Conversation's D.W. Gibson about what fuels their interest in agriculture.
The National FFA Convention and Expo is incredible. Through 98 years now of holding this convention annually, they've really cultivated an experience for not only FFA members, not only people involved in the agricultural industry, but for everyone and anyone who wants to come and learn more about what agricultural education is like, to really immerse themselves in this environment of students and educators and industry partners. And with over 1 million student members from across the nation, Future Farmers of America is the largest student organization. That means when you go up to convention, you're there with over 70,000 other FFA members from across the nation, not only from the 50 states, but also from Puerto Rico and the U.S. Virgin Islands. And to see all of these people being connected by agricultural education is just amazing. Lakeisha and I competed in agri-science, but there's countless other competitions for students to engage in. There's an expo hall where you have huge tractors and combines and industry partners, and you meet educators and you meet politicians and you meet all of these amazing people that are connected by the blue jacket that FFA provides.
And Lakeisha, it sounds like there's been efforts to diversify and make sure that this is an opportunity that more people know about and more people have access to.
Yeah, so one of the big mottos FFA goes by is FFA for all. No matter your background, no matter who you are, where you come from, FFA is for you. It doesn't matter if you're not going into agriculture production, you will still relate to agriculture and you can find a voice and community in FFA. Whether or not you do agri-science like me and Nicholas, there's always a competition or a person out there who relates to you. It's honestly a really good place to find new friends, find passions, and also learn more about yourself. And especially coming from Hawaii, we are the smallest delegation in the entire U.S. And being able to talk about what agriculture looks like in Hawaii and learning what agriculture looks like on the mainland U.S. is very insightful and helps us realize things we can apply here in our agriculture education systems.
Well, so tell us a little bit about the work that you did that was recognized.
Yeah, so I'd actually like to begin with the problem and the way we figured it out. It originally stemmed from connecting with people, and I wanted to combine it with one of my biggest passions, which is climate change and climate change advocacy. Simply, our project aimed to figure out how to make people act on climate change through educational or informational means.
So what did you do, Nicholas, to see what can be done to get people to act?
So what we did was we had to reach out to a network of educators in the agricultural and sustainability spaces to really reach out within their schools and send out this survey that got a lot of basic metrics about students. So what was their age? What is their gender? What is their race or ethnicity? Do they have experience in prior agricultural education? And what we did from those surveys was we sorted 195 students into different groups. And each one of these groups received an A or B type of stimuli. Type A stimuli was informative, informational, using data and straight facts. And stimuli B was emotional, pulling on the heartstrings, trying to see if we could leverage human emotion to enact climate positive action in students. And we distributed these either through email or Instagram, and we observed student action over a course of 14 days. So after giving them this information on a daily basis, we would remind students to fill out this activity tracker where they could select 1 to 10 actions that they could do throughout the household just in regular daily life to make a more positive impact on the climate.
So give us a real example, or at least a mock-up of an example of what you're talking about in terms of these variations you created over social media.
Yeah, so the variables essentially were just the different types of text we were putting on screen. All of the images were the exact same. The graphics were built the exact same way, thanks to Lakeisha's handiwork. And all I had to do was edit the caption. So maybe if we were talking about beef production, we would give a statistic. You know, this statistic isn't true, but maybe eating 2 to 3 more meals with beef a week adds to a 2% increase in carbon footprint for a consumer. That would be a fact. That would be an objective database statistic to hopefully influence climate positive action. Another thing we did was we pulled on heartstrings. So maybe the stimuli for that on the same topic would be every time you eat a cow, you are damaging the environment, where we're not giving any real trackable data, but we are trying to see how we can use subjective stimuli to influence action.
So Lakeisha, what did you two learn in terms of the sample set's reaction to these two forms of communication?
Yeah, so we found the most effective stimulant was informational Instagram posts. And I think this goes to show that people like the cold hard facts. They don't like being manipulated. They want to know what actually is going on and what's the truth happening. And it just goes to show when you connect with the youth or other people, you need to do it on a platform they use regularly and things that they already check. When you connect with someone, you must be in the same community, same things, and speak the same language, right? But what we also found was that although the informational Instagram posts were the most effective, this was only an outlier. About only 5% of our entire applicant pool actually did something over the course of the 14 days. And that honestly was pretty surprising to me. I thought these stimulants would help people and motivate people to actually do things to help the climate. But what we found was there was no such change. Despite being exposed to these stimuli over 14 days, what can we do to help them further motivate them? And I think that's something we can go into as we go into future projects with this same topic.
Yeah, because that seems to be still an open question, right? So you were getting more responses in terms of what they told you to the informational stuff, right? The facts, the cold hard facts. But you were finding, Nicholas, that that wasn't actually motivating action in a lot of cases.
Yeah, it's really difficult to say. So Lakeisha and I have been involved in agricultural science work for a number of years now. We've been doing it since the 7th grade. And when you get into social research, it's really hard to make the distinctions between your variables, what you choose to change in your experiment, and how they actually affect human action. And like Lakeisha was saying, even though we saw more people from information Instagram groups participating in action, the people who did participate were only outliers. So maybe if 2 people participated in a group of 10, that's still larger than the rest of the groups where they had 1, maybe even 0 people participating. But of course, we're only high school students, so we can't offer them incentives like pay or anything else to really engage them in the study. So for future research, something that we really want to do is look to control all of those things that we couldn't in our experiment to reach more conclusive data.
Another aspect of our experiment was their involvement in agricultural education as well. We didn't find that agriculture education had a significant influence.
As you engage students that are interested in agriculture, learning about agriculture, let's stay there for a little bit because I'm curious about the future of agriculture in this country, but perhaps more specifically the state. I feel like a lot of the prevailing narratives you hear are about people walking away from family farms, the difficulty of farming in the 21st century. What light can you shed, Lakeisha, in terms of your peers and their attitudes toward the future of farming?
Yeah, I think when we're talking specifically about Hawaii, we need to understand our historical standpoint, right? Less than 100 years ago, we were in the plantation system, and many of my friends and families came here and immigrated to work on the plantations. And because of that, their parents and their grandparents encouraged them to not go into a life of agriculture because it was hard. It was hard work, and they weren't paid that well. And they don't want their same children to go into a life of insecurity, as that's what agriculture in Hawaii is viewed as. In my personal experience, my family did not want me to go into agriculture at all because immigrating from the Philippines, it was seen as a really hard job that won't lead you to success. And my family discouraged me from participating in agriculture. But I think what FFA Future Farmers America does a really good job of doing is engaging those students not only in agriculture, but all its aspects that agriculture connects to. Agriculture at its core nature is connected to every single thing we do on this planet. Although I'm not going directly into production, I'm going into politics like Nicholas mentioned earlier, it's still something we all must appreciate and understand despite the paradigms we may come into coming from our families and culturally as well.
Nicholas, I'd like to get your thoughts on that too, because I think it's kind of a big question.
Yeah, that's a huge question. And it's actually something that I'm researching this year. We have competitions coming up in December, and I'm competing in a speech competition. And my speech is actually on the cultural barriers to agriculture in the young farmer's life. And something that I really pride myself on when people meet Lakeisha, and I have the opportunity to talk to people with her now that we're serving on the same team, is that in the eighth grade, when Lakeisha was a seventh grader, it took me a really long time to recruit her into FFA, because despite being in FFA and despite understanding the importance of agriculture, I did not know yet the cultural barriers that Lakeisha mentioned. The fact that in communities like our own here in Hawaii, the fact that we have such a rich culture based on immigration, families and their students have children who came from lives of agriculture, and they come here to Hawaii looking for a way to escape that life. And for students in our community now that are outside of FFA that we're trying to bring in, one of the largest barriers that we see is that their parents and their grandparents are constantly oppressing agriculture and an agricultural way of life, because that's what they know, that's what they came from, and that's what they came here to escape. One of our largest challenges are breaking down those cultural barriers and trying to figure out ways to be knowledgeable and be respectful of culture, but also try and change the culture around agriculture and make it appealing to these families who worked so hard to escape it. What convinced me to go into a career advocating for agriculture as a politician was understanding the agricultural industry's importance to life. As Lakeisha mentioned earlier, it touches everything from food to clothing to fuel to education to social structures to the economy. Agriculture touches all, and I think when people are not knowledgeable about agriculture, it's not a matter of malice or incompetence. It's a matter of ignorance. It's the fact that in our schools, agriculture is not a subject that is taught to every student. It's the fact that growing up, we eat food every single day, but we don't do the job of understanding where that food is coming from. And today in Hawaii, when our state of food importation means importing 90% of the food we eat on a daily basis, that really, to us, becomes an agricultural crisis, because we as students see the state of agriculture in Hawaii, and now we want to do all of this work to change it.
That was Nicholas Nishimura and Lakeisha Kitaug talking with HPR's D.W. Gibson about their recent trip to the Future Farmers of America convention. And that does it for us today. Tomorrow, we hear about something called the Democracy Initiative in one of our schools and why, with a rise in political violence, it's important to teach students about civil discourse. We welcome feedback. Email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. You can find the conversation on our website or as a podcast on Spotify or Apple. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us tomorrow for more of the conversation.